a series guided by George Ricker's wonderful book, What You Don't Have to Believe to Be a Christian. Alert congregants probably noticed this week that there is no chapter on faith and science. However, if you've read the book, you know that that whole issue of Christian faith responding to modern science, that is at the heart of George's thinking, and it's never very far from any single topic in his book. And when I set down this down as a topic for our series a couple of months ago, I expected that a Google search would inundate me with all kinds of amazing, ready-to-plug-into-a-sermon stuff about the intersection of faith and science. In other words, I thought this would be an easy sermon. Let's just say I'm glad I started early this week. What I found on the interwebs was two big batches of stuff. One was very scholarly. It was long papers and books about how some aspect of faith and science connect with each other. In other words, it was mostly stuff that I really didn't understand and that I couldn't possibly shoehorn into a 15-minute sermon. The other batch of stuff was equally inappropriate for a Sunday morning, but it was much more entertaining. I learned, for example, that there are dinosaurs in the Bible. Did you know that, there are dinosaurs in the Bible? This is the point at which you don't want somebody to just like walk into the service, right? And, oh, dinosaurs in the Bible? Okay, we're out the back door. Anyway, I had to do a lot of digging in this, and I hope you're ready to dig with me today. It's not an easy topic, and I think the fact that there is not much out there for the general public on that intersection of faith and science, that says something. The Cavendish Laboratory is one of the most famous labs in the world. It was founded at Cambridge University in 1874. Anybody been to the Cavendish Laboratory other than Harry Swinney? Okay. J.J. Thomson discovered the electron there. Ernest Rutherford split the atom there. Back in the 50s, Crick and Watson identified the structure of DNA. At least 29 Nobel Prizes have been associated with that lab. What's interesting to me about the Cavendish Lab is the words that are carved in Latin over the huge wooden doors as you go in. It's a quote from Psalm 11. Great are the works of the Lord, studied by all who delight in them. When the lab moved in the 1970s over to West Cambridge, the faculty insisted that the new doors be inscribed with those same words, except this time in English. Now, things have not always been quite so peaceful between science and faith, right? Here in Texas, the two line up like gunslingers at the OK Corral, ready to fight to the death. Especially at textbook adoption time, the tensions turn into outright warfare. Now, most of us in mainline progressive churches, we've long ago accepted modern science. We're okay with the theory of evolution. We have a more nuanced reading of the book of Genesis and what a day might mean. And so we really have no dog in this fight between creation and evolution. The debate over those two is rarely a part of our conversations in our churches. And the result is that we don't talk about science very much in the church. I mean, think about it. How often do you hear scientific settings, ideas in church settings? How often do you see science on the front bulletin, front cover of the bulletin? Art is honored in the church, especially today. Art is being honored in the church. Music, center stage, every Sunday, beautiful, gorgeous music. Our liturgy and our sermons, I hope, are shot through with prose and poetry and good stuff. Even dance. If Pastor Heather has her way, we're all going to be dancing soon, so toe shoes will be on sale after the worship service today. But science, it's like the proverbial stepsister, right? It's always waiting to be invited to the main event. Do you remember Garrison Keillor's famous question. He said, what do you call someone with a liberal arts degree? Does anybody remember the answer to that? What do you call someone with a liberal arts degree? Anyone? Boss. Yeah, there's probably a bunch of different answers, but boss. And yeah, I mean, it's funny, but it draws on a kind of hierarchy that says, well, of course, science is important, and we love it that you all do all of those amazing things that we don't understand, but the real stuff of life is in the arts. That's where the meaning of life is. Now, we can't fix all of this in one sermon, but I do hope that you will come away from today thinking about ways that all of us can bring science more closely into conversation with our faith. You know, I was thinking with the rise of the new atheism in recent years and some of the books that have come out and a number of the new atheists are or were scientists, it seems that we avoid this conversation between faith and science in the church to our detriment. When some scientists claim that religion is at best delusional and at worst poisonous and destructive, some response from people of faith is called for. Now, I'm not buying into the idea that there is a war on religion or a war on Christians. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But when faith and science are presented as competing worldviews that don't mesh, we have some work to do in the church, especially for our young people, our children, and our youth. Here's the way the problem is often presented. Science is based on facts. And scientific methods lead to real knowledge. Religion, on the other hand, is simply based on opinion. It's subjective. It's not true in any general sense, but it's just true for me or it's true for you. One of my favorite scientists is John Polkinghorne. He was a quantum physicist before he became an Anglican priest, clearly an overachiever. He argues that science is not completely objective, that there is always subjectivity in science. Do you remember Heisenberg's principle from your high school physics classes? I hope I'm getting it right. And Harry, you'll get me after the service if I get any of this stuff mixed up, right? Okay. The moment that you aim a photon at an electron to detect it, you disturb its motion, right? That's the principle. And at the quantum level and all the way up, the aims and methods of the observer, they affect the observation. And so science is always wrestling with subjectivity, just as religion is. And the point here is not in any way to denigrate the scientific method, okay? But to say there isn't this vast chasm between scientific knowledge and religious knowledge. Both are after truth. Both are prone to error. Both are open to the wonder of discovering new things, although religion, let's face it, has a lot to learn about being a little more open. And both need each other in our quest for understanding the world. One way that I've heard the relation between science and religion put, and this is kind of an oversimplification, it's like this. Science asks the question of how. How did things come to be the way they are? Religion is asking a little different question. Why? Is there a meaning and purpose behind what's going on? Now, if we want to understand what's happening, we really need both questions, right? I mean, we're better off with answers to both. The kettle is boiling because the burner is heating the kettle up. The kettle is also boiling because I want to make some tea. One cube for you or two, right? I mean, there's a meaning and purpose behind the kettle. Science and religion complement each other. We need both in conversation. I think science and faith are also connected in a deeper way because science, I believe, often points toward faith. I like what a biologist and Talmudic scholar Carl Veit says. I don't think that by studying science, you will be forced to conclude that there must be a God. But if you have already found God, then you can say, from understanding science, oh, I see what God has done in the world. Here's an example of what I mean when I say that science points toward faith. Let's use an example from the most famous scientist of all, Albert Einstein. once said that the only incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. Are you with me? The only incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. This bothered Einstein. What is it that makes the world so understandable? We just take it for granted that we can understand the world, right? Einstein's own special theory of relativity began as a thought experiment. What would I see, he asked, if I were to chase a beam of light at the velocity of light? And his answer that covered the blackboard with equations boiled down to an elegant equation that you know by heart. And it is exactly. What boggles the mind about that is that the mathematical pattern that came out of pure mathematics in Einstein's head matched the pattern in the world. The equation worked. Polkinghorne says that the universe in all its rational beauty begins to look like a world that is filled with signs of a rational mind. And so maybe, he says, what we're seeing is the mind of God at work. Why does reason and mathematics fit reason in our world? Why are we able to understand the world? Because there's a common origin in the Creator, the ground of all that is. That's one of the deep connections I think we can marvel at if we pay more attention to these conversations between faith and science. For me, that deep connection also means that we have to take the physical universe seriously in the church. For people of faith, the world isn't just a bunch of stuff, of inert matter. It's the dwelling place of God. It's the place where we see the beauty of God's work, where the wonder of God is revealed. Hopkins put it in poetry, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God." And so maybe with the push of science at our heels, maybe in addition to the sacraments of baptism and Eucharist, we need to add another one. The earth. The earth. The original sacrament. The primordial means of grace. How would we care for the world differently if we saw it pulsing with the energy of God's resplendent glory? To use George Ricker's words, a Christian does not have to separate faith and science into two airtight categories that never speak to each other in order to preserve faith. But Christians may believe that conversations between faith and science are not only necessary for both, they enrich our lives. And they move us to embrace the divine vision where all flourishes and all means all, from the trumps all the way down to the golden cheek warblers. Javier Lapichon is a geophysicist who was instrumental in founding the field of plate tectonics. He tells about an experience that he had way back in the early 80s. He was descending to the floor of the Pacific Ocean. At that time, it was the deepest that a human being had ever gone in the ocean. He said that being close to where the Earth's crust is being constantly renewed was like being present at the moment of creation. This is a scientist speaking from his faith. Creatures came into view that had never been seen by human eyes. Because of the darkness, there was no need for them to hide from predators. Their colors, their size, their shapes were breathtaking. For Lapichon, the encounter was both revelation and mystery. He said, "I felt like Adam. I felt like Adam. For me, all I could do was pray and give thanks." What do you do when you encounter the divine in the course of nature? When language just eludes you, you worship, right? You pray. When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you have established, what are human beings that you are mindful of them? Mortals, that you care for them. Yet you have made them a little lower than God and crowned them with glory and honor. Isn't that the very best news of all? That we're not political units. We're not animated lumps of flesh or consumers or advertising targets. We're not our jobs or our salaries or our degrees or our children. At the core of our being, we belong to God. Thanks be to God. Amen.